Welcome to the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. In today's episode, we put the focus on a quite interesting country, China, with Damien Glendinning from Complex Countries. Damien retired in 2018 after a career which included 21 years working for IBM and 13 years as group treasurer for Lenovo. Complex Countries is an online peer group for corporate treasurers. They hold regular calls, usually weekly, where a small group of active corporate treasurers discuss topical items, usually, but not limited to, countries where it is challenging to work. In the episode of today, expect to learn, how has China's banking sector evolved and how does it influence current banking relations? How open is China for international business in treasury management? What are the regulations and practices for domestic cash pooling in China? What challenges do foreign companies face in China regarding payment alternatives and banking services? How do China's regulations affect international treasury management, including exchange controls and working with local and international banks? And like always, much, much more. China is a topic we wanted to discuss for a long time on the show because of its unique environment. Damien and the team at Complex Countries are extremely knowledgeable about it, and it was a pleasure to have him on the show. We truly hope you will enjoy this episode. If that is the case, and when you're thinking about how you found our podcast, chances are that it was through word of mouth, social media, or a recommendation from your favorite podcast platform. And this is our only request to you. The best way you can support the podcast, wherever you're listening to this, is to head to Apple Podcast, search for Corporate Treasury 101, and give us a 5-star review. That would mean the world to us and help more people learn about treasury. And with all that being said, please welcome Damien. Damien, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Today, we're going to talk about something we wanted to talk about for a long time on Corporate Treasury 101, which is China, and more specifically, corporate treasury in China, obviously. So please, can we start with you providing us with an overview of the banking sector in China? And I'd like to even go a bit deeper in the sense of noting the historical context of the bank's evolution from state distribution tools for-profit entities.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Secondly, I'm sure somebody someday is going to write a book about the Chinese banking sector, and it'll probably be about 15 volumes long. So it's a very big thing. If I may, before we get there, I'd just like to start with a little bit about the country itself, because I find, first of all, you know, obviously having been treasurer of a Chinese company with responsibility for the domestic operations as well as the international ones, I find that a lot of people tend to suffer from misconceptions about China. We all think of it as this big monolithic country. You know, people have pictures of the parades on Tiananmen Square with perfectly disciplined, very well-groomed troops. And they exist. And by the way, I wouldn't want to be up against them on a battlefield. They certainly are very formidable. But the reality is that it's a very large country. It's as big as the United States. Most people forget that. Everybody is aware that it has a very large population, but it also spans different climate regions. So, you know, we all think of rice as being the main dish. Well, it only grows in the south. In the north, they mostly eat wheat and bread. And in fact, the Chinese invented pasta. There is a reason for that. So people forget how big it is, but they also tend not to realize that it's a country where discipline and order do not come naturally. You know, the Chinese idea of a queue is a whole bunch of people standing around everywhere, and then they'll all fight each other when it comes to getting ahead first. It's not disciplined, and every time there is a regulation, the first thing any Chinese person does is to try to find a way around it. So we all think of this as, you know, people, when you watch the news, people talk about China has a great plan and everybody in China is going along with it. Now, China does have a plan, but getting everybody to go along with it is actually one of the biggest challenges. And a lot of the people tend to forget that, in fact, maintaining internal order and discipline is one of the top priorities of the government because it doesn't happen by itself. So I'll stop there, but it's just important to recognize that we all think that everybody, that all the leader needs to do is to say, do this and everybody will fall in line. It doesn't actually happen that way.
Yeah, but so actually let's dig into that, Damien, because that's super interesting. So, and especially with your view from complex countries, right? You're probably the person to talk to when it comes to that. What do you think is that? Why do you think we have such a conception of China? We are both in France at the very moment, so maybe in the Western society. But how come we have this image of that country? And obviously, as treasurers, making the link between that image we have with whatever must be happening in China. Why is that?
That's a really good question. I would like to be able to answer it, but I can't. I think a lot of it just boils down to ignorance. I'm sure what I've said will resonate with everybody who's been there, and most of the treasurers who are listening to this, I assume, have been there and have business there. A lot of the time, the picture you get of a country is based on what you see on the news. And I don't want to cast aspersions on the news organizations, because they all do a very important and a very good job.
Right.
But by definition, they will focus on the things that are visible, that make news. I mean, I can remember, for example, once when I was IBM's regional treasurer in Asia, based in Singapore, there was a lot of unrest in Indonesia, in Jakarta. So you'd sort of watch the news and you'd see, you know, Jakarta is aflame, there's massive demonstrations everywhere. And we'd call the people in our office in Jakarta and say, are you okay? And they say, of course we're okay. Oh, there's 10 stupid guys standing around a camera in front of the building. That means we'll have to take the rear exit this evening. I'm not saying, yeah, the news does what it can, but it tends to focus on a certain number of things now, sort of, you know, for example, the People's Liberation Army, the PLA in China, is the world's biggest army by number of people, but it's a peasant army. So yes, it has the crack troops, absolutely. But you're also likely to see somebody in a PLA uniform sweeping the streets. Now, that's not newsworthy. But it is a key part of, until you actually, and also one of the biggest problems is the language barrier, well, which makes life, and do actually speak more than just English. I tried to learn Chinese when I arrived in Asia, and it's extremely difficult. So I'm afraid I never got very far, but for me, it's really a question of saying that there is a very different culture. And I think most Westerners have a problem understanding how different it is. But the only reason why I raised it, and I think, you know, before we go down this rabbit hole, the reason I raised it is that certainly one of the things that every treasurer complains about when dealing with China is regulations. And one of the issues is that the regulations are not necessarily very clear, and they keep changing. And that also, the reason I mentioned it is that this is, in fact, for me, one of the reasons is that, in fact, you don't have a tradition of a strong central authority laying down clear laws. You have a central authority which may or may not be strong, that varies according to the periods, but you have an enforcement of laws which tends to follow a very different process, and that's a very important thing. So that's the reason I mentioned it is very important to bear that in mind when you're dealing with China, is that some laws and some regulations are very clear and will be enforced very strictly. A lot of other ones are actually kind of open and everybody's finding ways around them, and that's one of the challenges when you're dealing with China. So sorry for that little parenthesis, but I would love to understand why we all have such a different conception of the country. But it is important to remember it is a very big place. It is very varied. And by the way, you know, one of the things that's been happening over the past 100 years is unification of the language. People speak different. Are they dialects or are they different languages? I don't know. But a native Beijinger will not necessarily, you know, if you plump him down in Hong Kong, he will not understand Cantonese. They get to understand it. You know, they can learn it very quickly, but you know, certainly one of the things that happens is that, and by the way, this is also one of the other things which is very, I'm sorry, I'm going down another rabbit hole, but
I love that.
One of the things that's very interesting is why does China still use the characters? You know, the Chinese do not use the Roman alphabet. Now, partly it's, of course, justified pride in their culture. But actually, Mao's government tried to introduce Western characters. But one of the problems is that Western characters work if everybody is pronouncing the words the same way.
What do you mean?
In China, they don't. So that's why the Chinese character system is based on pictograms. So if you've got a picture of a car, well, you don't need to call it the same thing. You recognize the picture. So traditional Chinese calligraphy is based on pictograms because that way everybody could understand what's written, even if they couldn't understand each other when they speak. And so Of course, it's not going to change at this point, especially as now computers have made it much easier to type in Chinese. And by the way, in case you're wondering how it happens, it's a Lenovo invention that you key in the letters that on the Roman alphabet, on a Roman keyboard, which constitute the sound, and then it will propose three or four characters which match with that sound, and you choose the one you want. So that gets away from having to use your, because a traditional typewriter to type in Chinese needs 2,000 or 3,000 characters, and it's a little inconvenient. So that's taken a lot of the stress away from that goes with the character system. But all of that, again, to say that the problem with the pictograms, and I don't speak Chinese well enough to know it, but I do know that if you ask, if you give a text to three Chinese people and ask them what it means, there will be slightly different versions. So again, all of this to say, it's important to understand that things like legal certainty that we're used to in the West are just not part of how things work in China. Now, let's stop that and let's get back to, I think you asked about the banking system.
But so just to close on this, Damien, I just Googled it because now I was intrigued and wanted to know. So indeed, there are 8 to 10 main languages groups, but there is up to 302 different languages spoken in China. That's insane. I didn't even know.
It's a very big country.
Literally.
I mean, the risk of repeating myself. People forget. It's as mainland China is as big as mainland US.
Yeah, that says something. Huh?
And it probably has, and it has just as big, if not a greater, climatic variation. And, you know, northern China gets very cold. It's important to remember this, that people... Now, but one thing which is very important, obviously I don't want to get into some of the regional stresses that exist, but the thing that they all have in common is that they're very proud of being Chinese. Again, there are possible exceptions to that, but that doesn't even mean to say they speak the same language. They certainly have very different traditions, and the food is very different. It's just worth remembering all of that, that yes, there is a sense of belonging to a community, but at the same time, that community is not uniform. Yeah, and you're French, and I live in France. The people in the south of France are different to the people in the north.
So I heard, indeed.
So, yeah, we understand that. And I'm English, people in the south of England, people in the north of England don't see things the same way necessarily. But our countries are relatively small compared to China. So just to close on that, again, it's important to remember that it is not, while there is no doubt that it is a united, you know, it is a united country, there are massive differences. And also, one of the things the government is very, very concerned about, and it's in, again, a lot of people forget this, because we are, of course, in Europe, we're very concerned about the competition from China, you know, China taking away jobs in the West and so on. There's somewhere between 400 and 600 million people in China still live in what are very, very primitive conditions. Yes, the country has become wealthy along the coast, but it has not become wealthy in the desert areas in the West. And one of the big concerns the government has is they don't want everybody leaving the land in the West and flooding the cities, because there aren't jobs for them, and that is a recipe for trouble. And there, so again, there's all of these things, and it's, for me, it's important whenever you come across something which is a challenge to try and see the other guy's view of things. And that's something I think we just don't do enough when we're dealing with China. I mean, are there issues? Of course there's issues. But again, I think if you put yourself in the position of, you know, one thing I always say is the job I would never want, or would never envy the guy who's president of China, because it's a very, very difficult job.
Sounds like a tough one indeed. No, but I think it's good, Damien, that you took us through a bit the context of the country, because, I mean, I didn't have a clue of many of the stuff you talked about, but it's also good just to have a refresher of how complex and big the country we are looking at can be, simply like on all things. But then obviously when it comes to treasury, there are so many implications like derivated from that. So
I'm sorry, I'm going to carry on since you've raised it. The other thing we forget is 100 years ago, this country was pretty much in the Middle Ages. And if you take a look, and this is something that for me, when we're dealing with complex countries, we tend to forget, is that if you look in from a European point of view, how long it took us to move from a feudal society to the modern society, modern industrialized society, and how painful it was and how many issues we went through. China and many other emerging markets have been through this process and very, very quickly. So it's not surprising, it shouldn't surprise anybody, that this has not been without its challenges. So I'll stop now.
No, that's good. But so let's indeed close the introduction chapter. But I think it was very good that we had it, Damien. So thanks a lot for that. Let's dive into the meat of the sausage, as one of my Irish mentor used to say. How does that reflect into the banking environment in China? Noting all those historical contexts, right, of the bank's evolution from state distribution tools to for-profit entities. How did all that take place?
Well, I'm sorry, but you can't ignore the fact that under the political system, and let's just deal with that very quickly, because the government is run by the Communist Party. Now, to what extent is the party still an ardent follower of the precepts of Marxism and Leninism? The answer is probably not very much. But the government, the Communist Party, absolutely runs the government. And for a very long period of time, all private enterprise was banned. And so the banks were simply a distribution means for the national budget. With the reforms that were introduced by Deng Xiaoping, the banks started to become a lot more commercial entities, but they, if you like, they still remain. You still had everybody in there that viewed themselves as, they were civil servants, and their job was simply to distribute the money according to the party's wishes. Now, the transition from that, so initially, for example, there was no credit evaluation. I mean, they never bothered whether they could get paid back or not, because that wasn't the objective. So they started to introduce things like credit functions. And if anybody, and I'm sure everybody on this call who is interested in treasury is obviously interested in credit evaluations, and we know how difficult that is and how many factors there are. But we have a long tradition of doing this. Now, when you have no tradition of doing this, it's a challenge. Plus, also the fact is that there are many things in China which, the government exercises influence in many ways, and a lot has to do with how powerful people are and so on. So all of this is to say that the notion that the bank is there to serve the customer is not actually the basis on which the system is built. Let's put it that way. So providing customer service is kind of a novel idea, and it hasn't necessarily made it to the top. But also linked into this, and this is very important, if you take a look in the West, most banks started or have a very important function of dealing with consumers and providing services to consumers. In China, that tends not to be so much the case. So, for example, credit cards. Domestic credit cards are kind of rare. They're not particularly used. So one of the things that's happened, and again, this comes back to this is why I went through the thing at the beginning. If you're in a country where most people don't have checkbooks because checks don't really exist, again, that's not part of the service that banks provide. They don't provide credit cards. How do you start doing, and again, it didn't matter because the consumer wasn't really a factor in the economy. You didn't have large purchasing power for the consumers. With the opening of China, with its industrialization at the end of the 20th century and carrying on into this century, you now suddenly have a very wealthy middle class, and the consumer suddenly has a lot of money that they need to spend. How do they do it? Now, I know I've had my Chinese colleagues and friends used to tell me, regularly told me that when you bought a car, you had to go to the bank with a suitcase, get out, leave the bank with suitcases full of 100 renminbi banknotes, and then go to the car dealer and deposit the banknotes with the car dealer. I'm not joking. I mean, this is 15, 20 years ago. I think we all understand the drawbacks to that. What you've ended up doing is that solutions have been found, but it hasn't been the banks that have found those solutions. So everybody, and one of the things that come up all the time in our discussions in complex countries is WeChat Pay and Alipay. So what you've had is that internet companies have actually stepped into the void. And a lot of basic consumer financial services are provided by these companies. Now, why the internet companies? Again, one of the things that's interesting is that China, and most people don't give China, in my view, sufficient credit for this. China may not be where most of the hardware innovation takes place in the IT industry, but it is definitely where a lot of the software innovation is happening, and especially the use of the internet. I think the internet plays a much greater role and is much more advanced in China than in many other places. And so trying to sell online without credit cards is a problem. So the internet service providers who had online merchant sites had to invent a way for people to pay without credit cards. Hence WeChat Pay, hence Alipay. And of course, these have now become a requirement. And my view, you're already beginning to see it, but at some point, this is going to kind of creep into the B2B space, business-to-business space. Now, that, of course, has then led on to, increasingly, employees are asking the employer to pay their bank, to pay their salaries, not into their bank account, but into their WeChat Pay account or their Alipay account, because that's where they pay everything from.
But where is the money held on those WeChat and Alipay accounts? Ultimately, it's linked to a bank, no? Or is the internet provider providing the whole infrastructure for holding money as well?
Well, that's a great question. And the immediate answer, and again, I don't pretend to know everything that goes on in either of these companies. It would be presumptuous and wrong of me to do so. But obviously, they do deposit money with the banks. But you know, it ends up being one very large deposit rather than a whole series of individual consumer ones. But also, this has led to the obvious thing, which is they're now sitting on large amounts of cash. So what are they doing? They're starting to provide all sorts of other financial services, which has put them on something of a collision course with the regulatory authorities. Now, the regulatory authorities find themselves with a problem that these guys are too big. You know, these guys have become so big, it becomes a challenge regulating them. So that's a battle that's kind of playing out a little bit in the background. But for example, they are beginning to, you know, they certainly provide money market funds. Because again, it's there's not that many investment opportunities if you're a Chinese consumer. So they're starting to provide that. And of course, this means that they now have substantial muscle. And again, for example, one of the things that we were doing in Lenovo, and come onto this, because another important thing is things like bankers drafts. Because getting loans from Chinese banks can be quite challenging for a whole bunch of reasons. Again, it sort of depends on where you stand in their historical relationships. But the way in which, especially as private companies started to come out, they were not top of the list for getting loans from the state banks. So you've ended up with a whole series of financial instruments. And one instrument that our members come across a lot, which is very important, is bankers drafts. So what you can do is you can get the bank, if when you're buying something, you can get the bank to issue what's basically a bill of exchange, where it's a, you know, it's a post-dated check but written by the bank, which is they will, you know, the bank will pay you, the supplier, in 60 days, and then, you know, you negotiate with the bank when you pay them. Now, this is how you get round, and this is a tool that's often used to get around loan quotas, because the central bank keeps a very tight control, or tries to keep a tight control over the economy, and one of the tools they use is limiting credit. That means limiting bank loans. So one of the ways around all of this is to issue a bill of exchange. Now, you have to pay for it, of course, and you have to do a deposit. But you end up with, so the point is that these things have become very, very common. It's all part of how do you provide the services when the underlying system doesn't do it. And that's a common theme in everything in China, is especially everything to do with consumer business and large volumes. The banking system itself wasn't designed around them, unlike Western banking systems. So you had these voids that are being filled by these various tools.
And is there not any new entry in the banking landscape of China who is just like, I'm going to take this position of a banking for the masses, for the consumers, but also for the corporates then? Is there not a place for somebody new to arrive in that landscape?
That's a great question. This comes down to some of the complexities. Remember that if you're looking by asset size, I forget what the number is, but is it four of the world's 10 largest banks are Chinese? So we tend not to think as corporate treasurers. We tend not, you know, if you're looking for a big bank to work with, Bank of China or ICBC tends not to be top of mind. Because again, they tend not to meet the service requirements corporate treasurers place on them. But in any listing, in any classification of banks by asset size, these guys will be near the top.
So, I mean, once again, you're right. Not that I doubt you at any point, Damien, but I'm just like, I need to Google those things at the same time, because I'm like, what? I didn't even know that.
Please feel free to check.
Yeah, but I think it's also good to like give a bit of names, like top 10 largest banks in the world by market cap. So just so we know what metric we are measuring here. Obviously, we find JPM and Bank of America as the first two. But then Industrial and Commercial Bank of China Limited, exactly, top three. Position 5, Agricultural Bank of China. Top 9, China Construction Bank. And top 10, Bank of China. So that's absolutely insane. And I didn't know, once again, that...
I was actually guessing a little bit, and I knew it, but so it's actually 4 out of the top 10.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then, well, you have HSBC, but it's more of a London bank, so it's a bit of a particular one. But yeah, 4 of the top 10 banks in the world are Chinese.
By
market cap.
Well, that was by market cap, but it's also by asset size. They do have a certain amount of power.
Yes, a bit hard to like come and challenge that at first. I get that.
Especially within China, and again, with the exception of Bank of China, because Bank of China was, if you go back to the traditional structure, Bank of China was the one that did business outside the country as well as inside. But most of them are very focused on China, so you know, a very high percentage of their assets are in China. So that does make them very formidable competitors. Also, now that you've got, and this is a little bit the problem, I think if you gave the authorities the opportunity to go back to 1990 and decide, knowing what they know now, they might well have done it differently. But the problem is that you're now at the point where Alibaba or Alipay and WeChat Pay are enormous financial institutions in their own right. So again, it's if you want to compete with them, you've got to start by competing with them on the internet. That is no easy task, given how big they are and the dominant position they are. So you're kind of, again, remember, you are dealing with 1.4 billion people. China today is already the world's second largest economy. And that's with the GDP per capita, which is only a fraction of that of any Western nation. It's an increasing fraction. But once they start reaching the point where they're more or less, they're 50, 60, 70%, China will be by far and away the world's largest economy. So you are dealing, it's important to remember that whenever you're dealing with these entities, you're dealing with very, very big beings or beasts.
Behemoth, that's for sure. Okay, but so how does that, so in terms of banking landscape, relations and services provision within China, how does that work for treasurers then? Maybe to bring the discussion. I want to talk about several stuff, Damien, obviously, in this episode, but let's start with this. Like, how does those historical factors, and now that we have a proper context, like, how does all that continue to influence banking relations and service provisions within China?
Again, a short question. I would love to give a short answer.
It's difficult.
So I would put this into two different categories. First is how Chinese companies do things. And then the second is how international companies do things. And then, so let's start with the international companies, because I'm sure that would be of interest to most people. I'll just make a little parenthesis. As an international treasurer, when you find it's difficult to do what you want in China, you're not alone. It's the same for the Chinese companies. The big issue is that they don't necessarily try and do the same thing, so they're not forcing change on the system. But if you think it's hard, well, you're right, but it's not just because you're foreign. It's hard for everybody. The big problem that you have is that, of course, every foreign company comes to China and wants to do things their way, and it's not that easy. So the things that, and these are the things that come up all the time in our discussions, because complex countries, we do our peer group discussions with practicing treasurers. Everybody starts off by saying they want to centralize the cash, they want to pool the cash. Well, it is actually possible to pool cash within China. Slight wrinkle, or there's a couple of wrinkles which happen, but it's certainly very possible. The first is, under Chinese law, of course, each company is a separate legal entity. Each legal entity is a separate company, and every company in China has to have a written statement in its articles saying what it does and what, and it can only do what it says in those articles. Now, you cannot set up a commercial company and say, I want to lend money, because the only people who can lend money are banks, per the law. So you can't put that in the articles, which means that once you don't have it in the articles, you can't lend money. Now, cash pooling, of course, if you have different legal entities involved, is lending money. So you can't do it.
intercompany as well, then I understand.
The Chinese law doesn't recognize the concept of a group, or it's beginning to change, but I mean, basically, they're separate legal entities. And so I may have the same shareholder as the company next door, but we're different companies, and I cannot lend money to that company because it's not in my articles. I'm not a financial institution.
How do you do then?
So again, this is very Chinese. The law says you can't do it. So what do you do? Well, you go to the bank and say, if I deposit a million renminbi with you, will you lend it to my sister company next door? Let's negotiate the haircut. So the bank says yes. And so you end up with something called an entrustment loan. So intercompany lending started taking off, or intercompany pooling and intercompany lending started taking off in China fairly early on, sort of towards the late 1990s, early 2000s. And what happened initially was that each time you did it, you had to go to the bank and they produced a document and you had to put lots of chops on it. We'll come back to the chops later, by the way, they're important. It's, you know, the stamp. And over time, this became so common that now what happens is that simply it's, you know, you sort of do all of this, and then at the end of the month, the bank will send you a list of saying, these are the intercompany loans. These are the entrustment loans we did. But so entrustment loans are required to do cash pooling. It's a small amount of fee you pay for the bank, but in theory, all of these intercompany loans, because pooling is an intercompany loan, has to go through a bank and has to have an entrustment loan agreement. So again, it's all highly automated now. But this is very Chinese. So this is how you got the law that says you can't do it, and this is how you get around the law.
Okay, but so the whole concept, what I find super funny in that, is that the whole concept of in-house bank, quote-unquote, getting rid of the bank to have it in-house for some of the treasury functions, is basically not an option in China. Then, if to do anything related to in-house banking, you need to have it in your articles. But in your articles, you cannot have anything related to lend money. Then the whole concept of in-house bank is...
First, yes and no. And the yes bit comes in two flavors. The first is the Chinese authorities do study all of these things and do see what's going on. And so they said, okay, well, maybe we should do this, but we want it to be regulated. So there are actually areas, and there's... In Shanghai, you can set up an in-house bank. There's a special license that you can get for this, which actually gives you all of the authorities to do a certain number of things. But it's regulated and it has to have a minimum capital and all this kind of stuff. So it hasn't really taken on because, you know, some Chinese companies do it, and I know a couple of MNCs that do it. But most of the time when you say, well, you ought to put 100 million RMB in, most people start saying, well, not quite sure I want to do that. So, but it does actually exist. The other thing is, again, depending on what you want to do, you know, you can do just about everything through entrustment loans. You know, as I said, it's become very much just a, you know, you have an agreement with the bank, you send them the list at the end of every month of all the loans, and they say, can they write back and say, yes, those were entrustment loans, bang, chop. You still get to do most of the things, but it's just, it's always worth remembering. For example, one of the things that it's very difficult to do is FX, because foreign exchange is regulated. So again, one of the things with in-house banks is managing FX positions. Now, that actually gets much harder to find a way around. You can find ways around it, but that's much, again, you're not allowed to do FX if you're not a bank.
So give us a bit more flavor into that. Why? How do people do it then? Like, because there must be a way. How does it work?
Well, frankly, I haven't found too many people. So first of all, again, it's the, let's just a slight detour on foreign exchange, because initially China had some very, very strong and very severe foreign exchange regulations. You know, you couldn't take the renminbi in or out, and there was all sorts of controls. Those controls have been greatly reduced. And the renminbi is now becoming an international currency. And by the way, the Chinese authorities kind of blow hot and cold on that one, because on the one hand, they want the renminbi to be recognized as a sign of China's economic power and so on. On the other hand, they don't want foreigners deciding how much it's worth. So you end up with the problem with an international currency is you no longer control the exchange rate. And that is a control that China is not willing to relinquish. So they're kind of dealing with this challenge. But all of this means that it has been greatly relaxed. So initially, what you had to do to get, first of all, as always, payments for services were very heavily regulated. That's now much easier than it used to be. But payments for goods, for example, you had to pay for goods, you had to provide the invoice, the customs clearance, and all sorts of other things. And you had to give all of these documents to the bank before they could process. And only a bank could do the FX. Now, even today, it's still the same. So you can't have an in-house bank that does the FX. Now, what you can do is you can go through procurement centers. You can have a procurement center that does all of these things, and they will negotiate with the bank, and then they will pass that on to the... They will then resell internally. So that's how you do it, basically.
Okay, so you need to use, again, another third party which is specifically accredited and allowed by the law process.
You can own the procurement center, but the procurement center will still do its FX with the bank. The procurement center can be fully in-house. So that's how you can, you know... Intercompany netting, for example, is not allowed. But you can do the procurement center, which does everything and which kind of pulls together, and you can do gross in, gross out on the same day.
And geographically, is there, because you mentioned Shanghai earlier for the cash pooling part of it, is there, for those procurement centers, does it have to be in a specific location again, or how does it work? Do you have specific regions or locations that are more flexible?
Not necessarily, but one of the things that China has done over the years is when they liberalize, because the economy has, it's a question of half full or half empty. You can look at all of these regulations and say, boy, is it difficult. You can look at what the regulations used to be and say, boy, is it easy. So it has moved on a lot. And one of the things that they do is when they're looking at relaxing a regulation, they will introduce a special zone. Or a special area where you can do these things. So yes, there are areas, for example, Shanghai has its free trade zone called Waigao Chao. Shenzhen, for obvious reasons, because it's on the border with Hong Kong, tends to be a massive center for these things because you can sort of just drive trucks across the border. And it has its own free trade zone. So there's lots of free trade zones where these things are much easier than elsewhere.
You mentioned CHOPS earlier, Damien. Can you walk us through that, please? What are CHOPS? What role does it play? And what the, pardon my French, heck is that?
So basically, and this is something where, again, we Westerners tend to go and think that we have the solution to everything. And I remember when I worked for a very large American company in the internal audit department, we had all sorts of rules and regulations about who could sign a check and check signatures and so on. When you go to Asia, people don't use signatures. You have a CHOP, which is, if you go, it's a seal. It's basically a rubber stamp. And each person has their own rubber stamp, which is very carefully designed. It's very, very hard to copy it or imitate it. But when you sign, you don't actually sign your name on a piece of paper. You take this stamp out and you stamp it on the piece of paper. And actually, the way they check it is that they have a piece of tracing paper. You know, the paper you can see through? You have the stamp, and then you put it on top of what's on the piece of paper. And if it matches perfectly, it's okay. If it doesn't... Now, the reason I mention this is, again, Western companies, and this is my own experience, we tend to have rules and regulations about signatures. We tend not to worry about these things. Now, if you've got if you can get hold of the stamp, you have the signature authority.
Really? So it's a physical token that whoever yields it, has it, can sign, stamp on behalf of the company.
Well, once the company is that, well, in England, in the UK, we have the concept of the company seal, which is the same thing. Well, I don't think France has the same.
Doesn't ring a bell.
But if you can affix the company seal to something, the company has signed.
That's insane. So how, obviously, I'm seeing this from my perspective as working with Treasury Department and within Treasury Department. How does the delegation of authority works? How does the powers of attorney works? How does everything work? If you can say, okay, only that person is allowed to sign, or do you make sure then that your representative in China or in Singapore, depending on where your center is, has the CHOP and like has in it a form of vault? How does it work?
Well, and that's the reason I raise it. So these are absolutely the right questions. Unless you understand the system, it's a question you might not ask. So one of the things that you want to do is you want to make sure that you know who has the CHOP. You make sure that that person understands what they need to do, under which circumstances they can use it. and you need to make sure it's kept in a secure place. Yes, it should be kept in a locked safe, and you should probably have some kind of record of when it gets used. But yes, it's the kind of thing that you don't think about. And by the way, the same applies in Japan.
Okay.
Yeah, in Japan, I used to work for IBM, and we used to have a requirement that there should be a signature on the documents, and the banks would say, yeah, okay, fine, but we never check them. We look at the job.
There is the four eyes principle, which is really prevalent in any treasury department. How do you achieve that?
Well, that's one of the reasons why you tend to use electronic systems.
Exactly. But you cannot with the job, or can you?
No, you can't, because you can't require two jobs, at least not in my experience. By the way, one interesting thing they do is when a company signs a document, it applies the job. If the document has, if it's a contract, for example, with 10 pages, they will actually spread the pages across the table so that the chop will appear on a bit of it on each page.
Okay.
So that way, because, in France, for example, you have to put your initials on every page in a document.
Correct. Speaking of experience here.
So what they do in China is that they spread it so that there's one chop, and then you can check to make sure that that's the original document, because it will only be the original document if you can get all the, if you can align the 10 pages and reconstitute the job.
Interesting.
Yeah, just very, very different. But yes, this means that there is a big premium on electronic systems. You can apply the 4i system on the electronic systems. It's much harder with a company job.
So you just don't do it. You just trust that the right person has done the right thing.
Well, again, the other thing is checks are hard. It's China, it's not the United States, so you don't use checks anyway.
Exactly.
It's very rare, so everything is electronic. So now it's all electronic bank transfers. That's where you need to make sure you have all of the checks and controls in the electronic banking system.
Makes sense. You mentioned something else in one of our previous conversations, Damien, which was quotas. What's a quota in China?
This is something which is... again, very important in China is culturally, the Chinese culture is very driven by KPIs, key performance indicators. So everybody insists on having their KPIs, and people will do all sorts of very interesting things to meet them.
Okay.
And often it's a question of form over substance. So you will find that sometimes there are transactions in China that don't have a whole load of substance, but they are designed to make sure that somebody meets their KPI. Now, one of the tools that the central bank uses to try to control the economy, so when it's overheating, which happens a lot, they will try and control the amount of credit generated, and they'll tell the banks, stop lending. Now, of course, you can't just stop lending, but what they will do is say, okay, your loan portfolio is, say, just taking a number out of the air, 500 billion renminbi at the end of September. Well, at the end of December, you must cut it down to 450 billion renminbi. So what will happen then is that if you want to borrow money, or if you've got a loan that you're trying to roll over in the fourth quarter, once they've reached the 450 billion renminbi, it's not going to happen.
Okay.
So that's how they do it, is they simply say, hey, forget it. No, we've been told more. Now, the same thing happens with bankers' drafts. If you try and discount bankers' drafts, if that's also an area where when the government is trying to control the flow of credit to the economy, they will say, no more discounting of bankers' drafts. And there's a quota on that. There's an amount once they've reached it. So one practical piece of advice, which I'm sure any MNC treasurer listening in already knows, is if you need to discount bankers' drafts, do it at the beginning of the quarter, not at the end. At the beginning of the quarter, they still have quota left. At the end of the quarter, they don't. Now, this then leads to something else, which I know is a question that we often get from MNC treasurers, which is the Chinese banks will come to you and say, would you like to buy some loans off us? We'd like to do a repo with you. We've got a customer loan. Great customer, don't worry, no credit risk. We'll sell it to you on the 28th of December, and we'll buy it back from you on the 3rd of January. What are they doing? Again, KPIs, they're meeting their KPI. They're not really stopping lending money, they're just getting it off their books. And of course, this is not without, you end up with some strange discussions, because the bank commits to buy it back. There's no reason to believe they won't, and there's no reason to doubt the underlying credit risk. But you are, of course, getting into a whole area where most MNC treasurers will say, hang on a second.
Hold on.
That's not something we do. So these are known as wealth management products. There's a big, it's a big topic in dealing with treasury in China, is you have these wealth management products, which are really ways in which banks can carry on doing business while getting around bond regulation or another.
Yeah, so back to the thing you said at the very beginning of our interview, Damien, is as soon as you have a new regulation coming in, what most people will try to do is how to work around it.
By the way, this isn't just China. This happens everywhere. But
Correct. That's a fair statement.
But it's okay. Important to remember that KPIs are incredibly important in China. Yeah. And most people, culturally, but also even in government, people's compensation depends on meeting these. So if you don't meet it, you're going to get paid a lot less. So it does have a... It is a big factor in how people behave.
No, it makes a lot of sense. You touched upon cash pooling earlier and also foreign exchange management, which you basically can hardly do or through specific channels within the country. Can we touch a bit upon the international context of that? Like if I'm a treasurer who's trying to do cross-border cash pooling, for instance, or intercompany loans cross countries, is that something that, again, falls under another regulation? Is it a bit more flexible or even less? How does it all work there?
Oh, it falls under another regulation.
Of course.
It is. In fact, it falls under more than one different regulation, which is part of the joys of dealing with China. Mm-hmm. So it is absolutely allowed. So intercompany loans are allowed both in and out. Now they need to be registered. I think it's with SAFE, the State Administration for Foreign Exchange. So the loans have to be registered and they have to be approved, but they absolutely can be done, and it's typically not too difficult. You can do cross-border cash pooling. Now, what the typical structure for most MNCs is that they will have a cash pool inside the country, and then the company which is, or the entity which is at the head of that pool, will then participate in a cross-border pool, usually into Hong Kong, because the regulations make it much easier in Hong Kong. Now, the header for the domestic Chinese cash pool can also be in Hong Kong. Now, again, these things need to be registered and they need to be approved, and there are different registrations. There's two that I'm aware of, and I think there's another couple. One is run by SAFE and one is run by the CBRC, Chinese Banking Regulatory Commission. And they have slightly different terms. And I hesitate to get into too much detail on these because every time we have a call, we get slightly different versions of what the regulations are. So my recommendation to everybody is please check. But certainly one of them, or one thing that happened traditionally, was that you needed to zero the pool at least once a year. In other words, because the Chinese government wants to make sure that this is not being used as a means of permanent cash repatriation. Yeah. But it is temporary, and it is two ways. So you every now and again you have to pay everything back just to prove that it is genuine. So again, we're beginning to hear that this regulation isn't necessarily being applied. But it is important to go and check. But yes, you can do these things. There are rules and regulations around them. But it's very important to go and have the thing which is important in all of these things is to go and talk to the regulators to make sure everything is laid out as clearly as is possible. And it's not always possible to be 100% clear. But it is absolutely possible. So but it is regulated, so it's important to go and make sure that you have all of the approvals.
Makes sense. Something we didn't touch upon in the context part of this interview, Damon, but I think is leaning gently into what we are talking here right now. What I know, is that China has a kind of desire, right, to reduce its dependency on the dollar and also on SWIFT, which is basically an initiative from, Western society banks. How open would you say China is for international business as a country? How does that reflect in the realm of treasury management, also taking into account what you just explained about this, how to do treasury tasks internationally with China and other countries. How does that all lean gently into all that?
Well, that obviously is getting into some geopolitical discussions. Now, the problem, obviously, and there was a big discussion about it at the time, but when it was decided that Russia could no longer use SWIFT, if you were sitting in Beijing, you'd be looking at this saying, hang on a second.
I don't want that.
I don't want to be dependent on a system that is controlled by a country that I don't necessarily always see eye to eye with. So the natural reaction, and it's been brewing, obviously, tension between the United States and China has been brewing for a long time, and you know, we've seen all sorts of trade wars and so on. China has a very natural and normal desire not to be dependent on the United States. You're also seeing it, for example, that in the computer hardware area, all computer chips are basically controlled by American companies. China does not feel comfortable with that state of affairs and is investing massively in trying to develop homegrown chips. So I think the SWIFT decision on Russia, this is my personal impression, it's based on a few discussions with people, but I think it's very clear that this has accelerated the desire to make sure that China is no longer dependent on the US dollar or on banking systems that the US can decide to cut off at any point in time. For me, it's as simple as that. Now, you know, you've had the whole Belt and Road Initiative trying to develop a renminbi area. And how far will it go? I don't know. But for me, it's very simple. It's that they don't want to be in the situation where they're dependent. What does that mean in the meantime? It means that, you know, China is trying very hard to make sure that it develops its own alternatives. But for the time being, are foreign companies welcome in China? Absolutely.
Well, once you talk us through this, Damien, I'm thinking, how do you, from a corporate treasury standpoint, look at all this? Because you're like, okay, if anything goes to, how to say this in a corporate manner, well, if something hits the fan, how do I make sure that I've put in place a resilient system, bank connectivity channels China is, for a lot of big companies, a big market, right? Obviously, as you said, it's 1.4 billion people. It's a massive economy, second worldwide right now. You also, if it's not something in the same similar scenario of Russia, that you absolutely need to get out of, you want to be able to have a form of business continuity. So I'm thinking when you're doing a kind of banking redesign or even seeing how you're going to implement your treasury systems in China, SWIFT is probably at the top of the discussions, right? Because it's easy, it's what everybody uses, it's what the big banks are connected to. How do you look at all this and make sure that you're resilient for the years to come?
This is a discussion I keep trying to have within the treasury community. You and I can have it. Interestingly, in most of the discussions, most treasurers are not really anxious to go there. I think people should be seriously asking themselves the question. But before you go there, and this is the reaction we get every time, is you have to step back and say, well, what would losing China do to our business? Now, for most companies, losing Russia was inconvenient, but not much more. China, for a lot of MNCs, a lot of international companies, China is very, it would be more than oh dear, that's a problem. It is a very, very big market, and it is very important. So one thing which is absolutely clear is that most MNCs are totally committed to the Chinese market, and it's just too big to ignore. So that has to factor into your thinking, which is, could you have a total split or a total decoupling? And the answer is, I think it would be extremely difficult, because just from a business point of view, it would be incredibly inconvenient at this point in time. Now, we are seeing some companies who say, well, maybe we need to start looking to India to hedge our bets. And are you necessarily going to want to have all of your production based in China? Well, maybe not. So you are beginning to see some people saying, well, maybe we should be looking to base production in other parts of the world. Apart from anything else, of course, China is a victim of its own success, and it's no longer quite as cheap as it used to be anyway. So, economic forces are going to make this happen. Then I think the real question, and this is where I would encourage from a purely treasury management point of view, I would encourage treasurers to start thinking about saying, as you see renminbi clearing systems or international renminbi clearing systems taking place, or as you see alternatives to going through SWIFT, I would strongly urge people to consider them very seriously, just so that you end up, so you don't end up in the situation where you are totally dependent yourself. I can't be more precise than that because they don't exist at the moment. But typically, as you've said, most treasurers will tend to say, well, you know, we use SWIFT, that's it, and we're not interested in considering alternatives. I would suggest that maybe you should start thinking, well, maybe we're going to be in a bipolar world.
No, and I like the way you put it. It's like, can we afford to lose China? You start by that simple analysis, and you're like, yeah. I suspect the answer for a lot. Exactly, I suspect for a lot of companies and treasurers, the answer will be quite straightforward. It's no, absolutely not. So how do we do from there to have a resilient approach and put processes in place that make sense and that navigates properly the choppy waters of Chinese regulation landscape, whilst making sure we can ensure business continuity. Damien, it was an absolute masterpiece. I learned a lot. Is there anything that you'd like to add among the different and very various topics we've touched upon? Anything we didn't mention or that I forgot to ask that you'd like to discuss?
Well, that's a huge country, and
you cannot possibly cover everything in an hour.
But the one thing that I want is to go back to the discussion we had at the beginning. Why do people have all of these misconceptions about China? I think they're misconceptions. Why don't we understand each other? And I think in many ways, the opening up, you know, clearly China is going through a period right now where it's reassessing a lot of things, where there's a lot of clamping down taking place. But at the end of the day, I think the way I would put it is when I was in Singapore, which I spent many years there, I listened to Lee Kuan Yew giving a speech about China. And it was at the time China was joining the World Trade Organization. He said, a lot of people are saying, should we let China into the world trade system? He said, that's the wrong question. China has joined. It's in. The only question now is, how do you deal with it? Do you view it as a positive thing and try and work with them? Or do you view it as a negative thing and try and block them? I think you know which side I stand on that one. And I think at the end of the day, having, you know, China is it's a massive culture. If you take a look at all the things that many inventions that we use today came from China originally. We have to find, you know, we have to find a way of working together and living together in a positive way.
Absolutely love that. Damien, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was absolutely great. If people would like to know more, because obviously, as you said, it's really hard to wrap up what China is, especially when it comes to treasury, in 1 hour of an interview. But so if people would like to know more, learn more about China, connect with you, or even explore what you guys do at Complex Countries, where should they go?
First of all, we publish a lot of stuff on LinkedIn, and there's a Complex Countries IT. Or otherwise, we have a website, www.complexcountries.com.
Absolutely awesome. We'll put all the links in the description. Damien, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Guillaume.